Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. And, you know, one of the things I hear walking around Chapel Hill sometimes is people say, gosh, our World War II veterans are, you know, they're not going to be with us much longer. And it's hard to get them to talk about what they experienced. And then sometimes I'll hear people say, well, I finally got my grandfather or my uncle or we finally got him to start talking. And then when he started talking, he couldn't stop once he – but it was just awful. And then we think about some of our – really our mothers and fathers and grandparents who have passed on without sharing these memories. So why haven't we done a better job of hearing and recording these stories of our World War II veterans? Well, thank goodness for UNCTV and the new documentary that it's airing this month. And thanks also to Scott Davis and to Brenda Hughes who come from UNCTV to tell us about the documentary. Brenda, you're the producer, and Scott, you're the director of external productions at UNCTV, and this is – must be a happy day in your lives.
Oh, it is a bit of a happy day, would you say? It's like our walk down the aisle, like the Academy Awards or something. It doesn't matter if we're nominated. We're just so happy to be at a point where it's finished and we can share it with everybody. And Scott, Scott is the all-everything director, so not just of external productions, but he directed this.
Well, the documentary is called North Carolina's World War II Experience. Is that what's the title?
It's yes, not,
and it so it tells us in a word or two exactly what you've set out to do. Scott, what did UNCTV want to do?
Well, DG, first of all, thanks for having us here.
Oh, yeah,
this is wonderful. And what we really tried to do was we tried to, in a way, recreate what North Carolina was like between 1940 and 1945 as North Carolina prepared for war because war was happening in Europe and actually in Asia. And then that eventful Pearl Harbor moment, which in a lot of ways like what we experienced with 9/11 back on December 7th, 1941, that the bombing of Pearl Harbor was such a dramatic event in the country's history but also in the lives of North Carolinians. And then to track several veterans, their stories all the way through the war until they returned in 1945 after the war was over.
And so that's what you asked Brenda to help you with, right?
Right. Yeah, very focused thing.
How did tell us the story about the assignment coming to you and how you?
Oh my gosh! Well, I must say this came to me after my mom had just had a stroke, and I had just finished another project about World War II, entitled "Thank You, Eddie Hart," and a lot of folks may have seen that. And really, I went after that story not because I was this great World War II aficionado, but it was just such a great story. So Scott came to me and he said, "Look, UNCTV is interested in doing this documentary on North Carolina in World War II, come on." And I'm like, oh, golly. it was quite a decision. And the thing, of course, that pushed me over to do it is because I absolutely love this state so much. And I love its people so much. And I love this generation so much. Scott and I are both baby boomers from, World War II parents. And
let me interrupt you just – and I apologize for that.
No.
Give me sort of – this isn't fair. I didn't warn you about this. But give me sort of your elevator speech, your 30-second or a minute speech about what this – what this production is, an hour long?
Yeah.
Two hours. And what is it in a word or two?
Well, before we say what it is, let us tell you what it isn't. It is not a chronology of the war in North Carolina, nor is it a chronology of the war overseas. It is not. But we did start out to research what happened in the state. That was very important to us because we felt like if we didn't understand it, we couldn't figure out what to do, you know. So we spent months.
So what is it?
Okay. I know. He's like down to that. We want that tagline. All right. The tagline is, this is personal, engaging stories of people who were involved in some way in World War II, either overseas or at home, and the impact that the war had on them.
Give us one of those stories in your words, right?
Yeah.
What you're going to give us? What you're going to give us in the 2-hour production that UNC TV gives us? Is this a lot in the words of the actual person or people who are associated
yes.
with him or her? But give us tell us if you were just telling me one of those stories. Do your best. We're not going to.
No. I love this, and it's hard to pick. Let me say. But I think I'm going to pick Bill Henderson, formerly of Raleigh, now of Oxford. Bill Henderson was a Marine, and Marines, I have come to appreciate, are so proud and so loyal and so devoted. Not that other branches of the service are not, but this became his identity. So met Bill Henderson in Raleigh one afternoon, and Bill was at Iwo Jima.
Wow.
Stuck out to me because my previous documentaries about the war had been involving soldiers in Europe. So the Pacific was an entirely new battlefield for me to learn about. So here we are, of all places now, on the beaches of Iwo Jima as Bill Henderson is landing. And he told us all about their briefing beforehand and how they had aerial photographs of the island and how the battleships bomb the heck out of this island. They had to have Iwo Jima because it needed to be a landing point from which, if they needed to go into Japan, they could because of Iwo. So he's painting this very clear picture for us of all of this preparation and all of this bombardment and how they felt like by the time the Marines unloaded themselves on this island, there wasn't going to be anything left. There wasn't going to be anybody left. Little did they know that the Japanese were hiding in caves and tunnels and the bombardment of this hundreds of ships, this flotilla of ships surrounding the island had very little effect. So here they come, and Bill's in about the fifth wave, and still the Japanese had held their fire. And then this fifth wave, sixth wave of Marines land, and they got blasted to the skies, and Bill really didn't hold back. He talked to – I'm getting emotional.
Keep going.
But, I mean, it has that impact when you hear these
stories.
So
he's making the way surely. I mean, he's losing buddies at every minute.
Right and left. People with their faces blown off. People with half their bodies blown off. He talks about this guy in his unit called Buttermilk, and he was a lieutenant, he's trying to get his guys to move. You know, they're stuck on this beach and they're getting just blasted to pieces, and he's trying to get his guys to move, and he turns around and he sees Buttermilk standing there, and Buttermilk is not moving, and he's like, come on, Buttermilk, we got to get out of here. And about that time, Buttermilk topples over and half of his body had been blown away. And Bill, you know, he says, and it was clearly, for me, a very emotional interview. He says, you know, you can't let that get you. You are trained to operate under chaos, and you just have to get in your brain, I'm a Marine, this is what I'm here to do, I've got to be, I just don't want to disappoint my country, I don't want to disappoint my family. You got to move on. And he did. But that's the kind of story I think that sticks in my mind.
And
for
we'll
the obvious
hear that
reasons.
Story
yes.
or, and see him tell
yes.
that story.
Yes, you
wow.
will.
Well, Scott, one of the things that interested you, and you mentioned this earlier, was what was happening to North Carolina during this time, back at home from the beginning of the war. What happened to North Carolina?
Well, I mean, North Carolina, as William Friday tells us, became a military encampment. In 1941, before the Pearl Harbor attack, Fort Bragg had 5,400 soldiers. A year later, in 1942, there were over 67,000 soldiers at Fort Bragg, and Life magazine actually reported that a miracle had taken place at Fort Bragg. The base had become the largest army camp in the nation, and had become North Carolina's third largest city. And so the expansion here in North Carolina, not only in terms of military bases and camps and airfields, but in Wilmington, they opened up a shipyard to make Liberty ships, which were cargo ships to transport cargo and supplies to Britain, which at that point was under attack by the Germans. And so we have one of our people that we interviewed said, you know, Wilmington was a quiet little town, a beautiful place, quiet streets. We had the beach that we would go to, and all of a sudden, you know, 20,000 people showed up to go to work at the Wilmington shipyard. And then just down the road, there was an anti-aircraft base called Camp Davis, where another 30,000 soldiers came in to train. So you can see there was just this amazing expansion of military training going on here in North Carolina. And actually, as we say in the film, by 1942, North Carolina had more servicemen within its borders than any other state in the country.
Well, you've got a clip from an audio clip from the video program that UNC-TV is showing is airing this month that maybe we could share with our listeners. And why don't we listen to that? And then Scott Davis and Brenda Hughes and I will be right back for more conversation about this wonderful production.
By the end of 1942, North Carolina had more servicemen within its borders than any other state. Many were at Fort Bragg, where workers built thousands of new buildings, and the population swelled from 5,400 to over 67,000 in less than a year. Life magazine reported that a miracle had taken place at Fort Bragg. The base had become the biggest army camp in the nation and North Carolina's third largest city. North Carolina also boasted one of the country's largest Coast Guard stations at Elizabeth City. Two large Marine bases, Camp Lejeune and Cherry Point. The largest glider base at Laurinburg Maxton. Anti-aircraft artillery center at Camp Davis in Holly Ridge. And basic training center number 10, which would become the Greensboro Overseas Replacement Depot, training and processing more than 300,000 Army Air Force personnel.
North Carolina became a military encampment.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Hey, welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm joined by Brenda Hughes and Scott Davis. Brenda is the producer of UNC-TV's production about World War II in North Carolina. And Scott is the director of external productions, and the two of them worked together to get this production in shape and on the air, North Carolina's World War II experience. Scott, before the break, we were talking about the boomtown in North Carolina, but you all found out that it wasn't all, you know, that there were some downside experiences, many downside experiences for those who were at home.
Yes, we had a very interesting conversation with a woman from Onslow County, and I'll let Brenda talk about her a little bit because her name was Marlene Blake, and she lived in Onslow County. And it turned out that Onslow County would be the home of Camp Lejeune. And so it was very hard for her family, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I found Marlene through someone who lived in Wilmington who had talked about, you know, the fact that their family had been evicted. And turns out Marlene was like a cousin or something like that. It was the kind of experience that to this day still impacts these families.
What happened?
Well, they essentially were told they're evicted. You got to get off your land.
So the land was condemned for the expansion of the base.
Right.
And how did they come to learn that they were going to?
People came around and surveyed the land and simply went up to them and said, "We need your land. You got a year to get out. And here's some money and buy," you know. And you know, some of these families had acreage that had been in the family for years and years, and so suddenly their home places they've got to go, and it happened to so many people. So Marlene tells a story about how she says a lot of people didn't have a car. So it wasn't like you could pile in the family car and go out and say, "Oh, let's go find a new place." You know, they didn't have a car, they didn't have a job, they didn't know where they were going. And so, when the time finally came for Marlene and her family to move, they piled everything they owned on a truck and started down the road. And they passed by some members of their family who were sitting on the front steps. They, too, were having to move, and tears were just streaming down their face. They had no idea where they were going, and they were moving that day as well. Marlene's family ended up, I believe, in a barn or something for a while, and then they finally found a place to live and soldiered on. But again, as I was saying at the beginning, it was the kind of experience that embittered them so much. Marlene said her mother, when she died, and I guess that was not so many years ago, she was still talking about it.
Now, who was she? To whom did all of this anger – at whom was all this anger directed?
I would assume the government, the fact that they had, you know, they just really had no choice about it. They needed to build Camp Lejeune, period. And, you know, you can understand both sides of the story. But for those who were affected, it was obviously tragic.
And, you know, DG, excuse me, also we were just coming out of the Depression at this time. In fact, 1940, in the News and Observer, there was a headline, you know, best retail sales at Christmas, you know, for retailers. So this was not an easy time even, going into World War II. And so here were people with very, very little money, very, very little really that they owned. And having this piece of property was so important to them. And then to basically have somebody come in and offer you $1,000 and give you 1 year's notice to leave, that was it. And we have a wonderful photograph from Onslow County with this fellow, you know, receiving a check from the government. And, you know, he was going to be gone.
Well, I think you've also got a clip from the production with Marlene Blake, this woman whose family lost the property. And maybe we could close out this segment by listening to that clip. Scott Davis and Brenda Hughes and I will be right back to talk about this wonderful UNC-TV production about North Carolina's World War II experience. We'll be right back, but in the meantime, listen to Marlene Blake.
Marlene Blake's family owned a farm in Onslow County, in a tract of land that was destined to become Camp Lejeune. They were offered $1,000, and given 1 year's notice to leave.
There wasn't very much money then. We didn't have any money much. It was really hard for them to take your home away from you. And maybe you didn't even have a car, and you were not even going to have a job when you got there. And you really didn't even know where you were going. And your home that you had worked hard for and planned for, you know, it was gone. There were some people who didn't own any property and didn't have anywhere to go or anything. So they loaded them up and moved them over the boundary line and put their things out.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about World War II and the North Carolina experience in World War II, and that's the subject, and that's also the title of UNCTV's original documentary about our state's experience during World War II and the experience of some of our soldier citizens overseas during World War II. Scott, you manage external productions for UNCTV, and this has been something that's been on your agenda for quite some time.
Yes, this is a project that we've been working on for 3 years, and I actually had the good fortune to work with Brenda on this. And I served as the director of the production and the editor of the production.
And the writer.
And we co-wrote it together. And
everything else he did.
Well,
His chest is swelling.
we have said, you know, often that we were in the foxhole together. And you find after working for 3 years on a World War II documentary, you begin to use a lot of army
metaphors,
military metaphors. You know, what's been really interesting for us, I think, on this project is that we were able to spend time actually really researching North Carolina from 1940 to 1945. And I spent a number of hours in a little library in Raleigh called the Olivia Rainey Library with wonderful librarians assisting and going through literally reels of old News and Observer newspapers. I mean, whoever looks at newspapers anymore? And the thing that was so amazing to me, DG, was that these newspapers, you know, we read about history in the books. You know, we look at history books or textbooks. It was all right there on the front page of the newspaper. And one of the most memorable moments for me was the discovery on December 7th. So that was Pearl Harbor Day. And we are actually broadcasting our program for the first time. We're premiering our two-hour documentary on December 7th to tie in with this discovery. And that was on December 6th in Wilmington, we launched the Zebulon B. Vance Liberty Ship, the first Liberty Ship that came off the shipyard gangplank or gangway, was called the Zebulon B. Vance, named after the North Carolina Civil War governor. It was a huge moment. The governor was there. The governor's wife, you know, breaks the champagne bottle over the on the bow of the ship. There's a fantastic write-up about it with photographs on December 7th. And then right across from that, there's a headline, and it says, Roosevelt sends personal appeal for peace to Japanese emperor. And so if you're in North Carolina, if you're in Raleigh, if you're reading that newspaper at 9 o'clock, and all of a sudden, you know, you're saying, okay, Roosevelt's got this covered. I'm going to church. Everything's okay. And you come home and you have lunch and then you turn on the radio to listen to the New York Philharmonic, which one of our veterans did. And all of a sudden it's interrupted. 2 o'clock. Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. One of our fellows says, where in the heck is Pearl Harbor?
They all said that. Nobody knew.
So So we tried to, through this research, try to recreate that time and try to carry the viewers. And we were carried from story to story to story throughout the entire war, you know, until our folks finally come home. And that moment when they finally return to their families. And it's just an amazing story.
Well, Brenda, we this is not as much a surprise as it was earlier, but we've asked you to think of some of your favorite stories and that you learned about North Carolinians' experience in the war. Have you got another one you'd share with us?
I do. And, you know, let me say, I think people – one takeaway from this program is that it really helps those of us who are descendants of this generation. It helps us understand them and why they were the way they were. And you hear these personal stories, and suddenly it's like, oh, now I get it. You know, I get why they were so frugal, and I get maybe I get why they didn't talk about it so much. It was pretty bad.
That's interesting. I don't want to stop you on the way to a story, but you said, and maybe I get it why they don't want to talk about
it. Well, I'm saying maybe other people. Well, I certainly get it
now. No, all right. And we'll explain to the rest of us why you get it, why don't they like to talk about it? Or why didn't
it
they
was
like to talk
so,
about
it? It was so awful. You know, they went off to fight this war. They wanted revenge. You know, they were so taken aback by this attack on Pearl Harbor, and even though they knew what was going on with Germany on the other side of the across the Atlantic, this pushed them over the edge, and they were in recruiting stations hours later.
So they were angry.
Oh yeah.
But then when they got there, they found out it was so terrible that when they got back home, they did not want to talk about it. Is that the reason?
I can't put myself in their shoes, but I would imagine. You know, they go off and they want to fight for their country, or in some cases they wanted adventure. You know, keep in mind there was no television. We didn't know what was going on over, you know. We didn't have the benefit of the knowledge of the world like we do now. And again, they didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. One guy says, was it a place where they were diving for pearls? I mean, I didn't know. But they go over there, and then look how long – for those who were in the entire war, you know, 4 years for the most part. And then the sights that they saw. I mean, can you imagine walking into what you thought was maybe a POW camp and it's a concentration camp? Can you imagine the carnage – that you would see after a little town in Belgium had been bombarded from the air, from the ground, for hours and hours. And then you walk into that town and the carnage. I mean, you know, I don't the quote was something like blood, guts, legs, heads. You know, and this was Roger Casey, who was a replacement soldier in the 30th Division, who had that experience. And, you know, you're like, well, gosh, no wonder they don't want to talk about it. But also, in my mind, they were so proud and they came back with their spirits intact. And it's like, we got to get on with it. Virginia Russell says, who was a flight nurse, talks about being in a church service at the end of the war, and a chaplain is telling them, and I can, you can hear this, and it's so true. I mean, he says, look, you got to go back, and you've got to lead this country. You know, you're the next leaders that are going over there. So all of this shaped them so much. And we are now, even today, of course, the recipients of all of those things that occurred not only during the war but after the war when they came back and they wanted it to be better. They wanted there to be peace. They didn't want to have any more fights like that. They thought it was not going to happen again.
Well,
and, of course, it did.
Well, you've got a story that I want to hear. This is from a paratrooper, Tom Alley.
Yes.
That right?
Oh, my.
And
yeah.
I wonder before we – or as we take our break, if we could listen to a clip from the – UNCTV's production, North Carolina's Experience During World War II. And this is Tom Alley. He's a paratrooper from
101st Airborne from Charlotte.
Great. We'll be right back after you listen to this story.
About 1 o'clock the next morning, on June the 6th, 1944, we started getting our first anti-aircraft fire. Shortly thereafter, just a few minutes, we crossed the coast of France, and the anti-aircraft fire got heavier and heavier. We were given the signal to exit the plane. The officer that was to lead the group of men out of the plane, just before he went out, a shell exploded, and he was badly injured. So the man just behind him just pushed him on out, and the rest of us followed. I came out the door of the plane, and the tracer bullets looked so thick, it looked like stair steps that you could walk down. And you knew you weren't seeing but one out of four. Shells were exploding all around us. I saw in the distance in front of me, fires burning. There was a church bell ringing, church right in the middle of town. I still didn't know where I was. Turned out, I was coming down over St. Maria Glisse.
The small French town near where Ali landed was miles from his intended drop zone.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Brenda Hughes and Scott Davis, and they are responsible for a wonderful new production, original production, a documentary by UNC-TV, North Carolina's World War II Experience, airing this month, and I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to see it often because it's going to be a very popular production. One of the things we were talking about during the break, Scott says, you can't imagine, once you see all the great stories that we've got, the ones we had to leave, what we say, on the cutting room floor. That's not the way it works anymore. But there are a lot of stories that you let me just ask you this, Scott. What was the hardest one to leave on the floor?
Well, I think we had three that were so hard to leave on the floor that we actually turned them into additional segments. One was about a WASP, which is the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. She was a woman, female pilot who towed targets over the anti-aircraft artillery guns at Camp Davis. And we actually had one of our other people that we interviewed say, there was some nutball towing targets over anti-aircraft guns at Camp Davis. And then at one point in our script, we said, and that nutball towing the target. Later, we changed that to that pilot towing the target. And so we interviewed a wonderful woman named Helen Snapp, who talked about that experience.
And she was the pilot.
Yeah.
She was a pilot. Military brought in women as part of the WASP, and they did a lot of the same things that the men were doing. They were towing targets. They were transporting planes into various places, and they were very, very
– I hope the line was a long one.
Exactly.
It was, although they did say, you know, occasionally that those they had tracer bullets, and occasionally, you know, they would see close, they were getting real close. Another story that was really interesting to us, and we really struggled not – to find a way to put it in, and it just, you know, we only had 2 hours. You know, Ken Burns, you know, when he did his war series, he had 16 hours, and I'm sure he's complaining about things that he couldn't put in.
Right.
But we had another wonderful story about the training of war dogs at Camp Lejeune. They actually trained Doberman Pinschers to be Marines, to be scouts and messengers and sentries. And so one of our fellows, Robert Forsyth, who now lives in Pinehurst, was one of the very first dog handlers. And he talks about his experience not having any idea how to actually train these dogs at that time, and yet how effective they were because they could hear things, they could smell things, they could sense things that, you know, a human couldn't. And he talks about his dog, Liney, who was, kind of a rough dog. And he said, you know, imagine being in a foxhole with, a Doberman pincer on your chest, you relied on him to be able to hear things you couldn't hear. Now, one of the things that we did include in the program, though, and I think this was really a surprise to us, was we had a section that we call Love and Marriage. And as we were doing our interviews, people kept telling us that just before someone went off to war, they got married. And so we have a whole section of people saying, in fact, one fellow, as Brenda was saying, how this war just kept going on. Everybody thought it was going to be over by Christmas. There was even a song, we'll be back by Christmas. And yet, it kept going. It kept going. And one of our fellows, Bill Farabee of Moxville, whose brother, Tom Farabee, Major Thomas Farabee of Moxville, was actually the bombardier on the Enola Gay, which dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Well, Bill Farabee, who was already in the Pacific on a plane as a gunner and a crew chief on a plane, comes back for training in San Francisco, wires his fiancée, and asks her if she wants to get married. And she says yes. So he travels across the country on a troop train. They get married at Center Church in Moxville. They spend one day at the Robert E. Lee Hotel in Winston-Salem. And then he calls his officer and he says, I'm going to be – I need a little more time to get back. So he gets this extended leave. He gets on a train to go back. He has problems getting there because of the weather. And when he gets there, he's AWOL.
Well,
and so – They put him on the they quarantined him to the barracks for two weeks. And what does he say at the end? He says
it was worth it.
Yeah.
What he says is
crazy, but
he says it sounds like a foolish thing, but we were in love.
What a great story. Well, Brenda, we're running close to time. Have you got a story that you can share with us?
I think just in general, one of the most touching things is when these guys are describing coming home. And here they have, seen and done and seen all this horror and experienced finally the end of the war. And when they talk about coming home, even today, they tear up. It was such an emotional thing for them, A, that they survived, and B, that they were coming back home to North Carolina. One soldier, Tom Alley, who had, careened into the dark skies over Normandy, he talks about how it was to see his mother for the first time. And he got 13 rides from Fayetteville to Charlotte so that he could, he says they were taking so long to process everybody. By gosh, I decided I was just going to go home. So he thumbed 13 rides, came to Charlotte. His mama wasn't there. Then suddenly they pull up. And he still is emotional about that homecoming. Jesse Oxendine from Pembroke, who was the soldier who suddenly walked into what he realized was a concentration camp. So you can imagine what he had been through. And there he is I guess it was Fort Bragg where he was. And he goes to the bus station, and the bus driver says, "I'm sorry, son, there's no room on this bus." And he says, "I'm getting on this bus. I don't care if I have to ride on top. I am getting on this bus." And he talks about coming home. And you can just – those of us who grew up in this state can just imagine him pulling into the service station in Pembroke, North Carolina. The guy there knows Jesse, gets on the phone, calls his mama. "Guess who's here?" And there's Jesse. And very seriously, though, he says – and this is one of the more moving moments for me. He says, "My mama, she was on her knees every day, and I know that's why I'm home." So I think it was those stories also. I mean, we just can't imagine. We just can't imagine, but hearing it helps so much.
Well, what a great story. I'm certainly looking forward to watching UNC-TV's original documentary production of North Carolina's World War II experience. We've been really fortunate to have Scott Davis, the director of external productions at UNC-TV, and Brenda Hughes, the producer of this program. Great partnership, great result, and thanks for taking time to visit with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks to everyone who's listening. This has been Who's Talking, D.G. Martin. I'll be right back here soon.